because there are consequences writ large, all right? But it is a little heretical. Okay, so that probably fits in well here, but it's just a warning. The stuff I've been, people I've been doing this with are Phil Chang at the, now at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Not that Phil Chang, the new guy. Apparently there are two of them there. And also Christoph Frommer has been a major contributor here. And recently Uwe Kutschbein and Volker Sprinkle. Okay, so those are my co-conspirators. And just to give you an idea of where we're going, so you know when to walk out. First, I'm going to give a very brief overview of the TV extragalactic universe. Okay, just to give you a flavor of the kinds of sources I'm talking about. And I'm going to present a modest hypothesis, not a modest proposal. I think it's modest. I'm going to let you decide if it's a hypothesis or a result. Okay? And then I'm going to go through a litany of consequences. What assuming this one little thing does for you and what you can explain. And there's a large number of things, so it will become very episodic as I step through each one of these. And here's the main message, that if you want to understand the cosmic history of the low-density universe, you might actually have to do some plasma physics, and you certainly have to worry about these TV sources. All right, so the TV universe. We've only recently gotten access to it, and that's been through these Cherenkov telescopes and Cherenkov telescope arrays more recently. These don't image gamma rays directly. They image the consequences of the gamma rays impacting up in the atmosphere, and they're sensitive to things above 100 GeV. But by the time you get to 10 TeV, there's not very much. So this is kind of the energy band. So these are very high energy gamma rays. Unfortunately, even though these telescopes are actually quite large, there is a lot of collecting area, they have low sensitivities. And so that means that every observation with these kinds of things is pointing. You go find something interesting that you think might be emitting very high energy gamma rays, and you look at it for a little while and integrate up a spectrum. And here's the set of sources that they've looked at. So far, the TV sky is dominated by galactic components. There's the galactic plane. We'll get to that in just a moment. The answer is 100 GeV. All right, so the galactic components are things like these synchrotron-emitting supernova remnants. Okay, but this is a cosmology talk, so I don't care about those. I care about the extragalactic sources. And there are a precious few of those. Okay, they all look relatively uninteresting. They have power loss spectra, et cetera. But now we have about 50. And if you want to talk about the ones for which you have spectral information, there's about 30. Okay, and here's a list just plucked from the literature. Of course, I'm not involved with any of these observations. But now there's not quite a truckload, but maybe a bucketful, more than a handful now. So we can think about statistics. Now here's Latham's question. Because there are only about 30 that we can do statistics with, that we can play with, we really need to talk about other experiments that sample much larger numbers of objects. And Fermi is the closest one of those. Okay, so Fermi is this gamma ray observing space satellite. The LAT is sensitive to things between 100 MeV and 100 GeV, so that's the next big chunk down from the kinds of gamma rays that I'm mainly interested in here. But it has access to hundreds of sources, has high sensitivities, so you can do reasonable surveys. And that means you can do things like characterize source populations. And here's a picture plucked out of one of the Fermi papers that shows their two main contributors are these flat spectrum radio quasars and BLX. All right? And it turns out that the BLX are the things that are hard. So this is photon spectral index. So if you're an astronomer, that's spectral index plus one. BLX are hard. And the flat spectrum radio quasars are soft. So in the end, we really care about these BLX, and in fact, a subpopulation thereof. So these BLX have this kind of typical spectrum. It has a synchrotron peak. And then there's this Compton bump. And that's what's emitting in the gamma rays. Here's the Fermi band right here. And since we're interested in gamma rays above the Fermi band, we're really interested in the populations of things that are very hard here. So not this. OK, here's these. Low synchrotron peak sources. The main point is that they're diving in the Fermi band already, so they're going to be pitifully dim once we get up to where we're interested. But we're interested in these guys, things that are flat or rising, Okay, so these are what I would call hard gamma ray blazars. And they typically are dim, okay, and of course, by definition, hard. Now, these aren't really different. They're not distinct. It's just a slightly different flavor. We can look at these kind of sequence of these blazars, these gamma ray blazars that go from these low synchrotron peak objects that are diving in the gamma rays all the way to these high synchrotron peaks, which are the flattest or even rising up and through the TV. Okay? And it's this continuous sequence. These tend to be the dimmest, all right? And again, these are the ones we're interested in. Now, because Fermi is able to go and characterize these sources, and certainly there's many other observations, radio observations, et cetera, you can bring to bear, we can apply to each one of these sources some sort of source type. And you can see that they really are all these high, H means high synchrotron peak, or I, intermediate synchrotron peak sources, all these hard gamma ray blazars. We have five sources that aren't. One's a quasar that's terribly bright, a radio galaxy, a couple radio galaxies that you only see just because they're so close, and BLAC, which you observe because it's BLAC. Okay. But the first thing you might notice about this table is that they're all very close. Okay, so we know what they are now. They're these blazars, and they're all very close. Certainly the ones that dominate the flux at Earth are close, but all of them are close. And I said, you know, you can't really do statistics, but as a part-time astronomer, I'm shameless, and I will anyway. We can plot the number of sources as a function of redshift, okay, and you see that by the time we get to point two, they've completely dived. And there are two answers for that. There are two reasons why that might be the case. One is maybe there aren't any further away, and the other one is maybe those TV gamma rays are absorbed. I'm going to argue that this is the case a little bit later, but this is universally accepted to be true. They are absorbed. And how is that? Well, imagine we have our blazar. Yeah. Yeah. Number of sources per unit redshift. Yeah.
But that seems to be integer. Why is it an integer?
I'm counting up in redshift bins. So I should have divided by bin size.
There's one at 0.45.
Yes, that's this quasar. That's 3C279. Yeah?
Do you have heard about the solution of the gamma ray sources as a function of redshift? What do you expect to see if nothing is observed?
Let's talk. This is an important thing. We're gonna get to that in great gory detail, because that's a much more complicated question than it sounds like, right? But just wait on for a little bit, and halfway through, if I don't get to that, ask again.
So do other quasars also show up?
This is the list of objects that you have spectral information for. So anything that I could get a spectral index for, or probably Phil could get a spectral index for, is on this list. And this is about 60%, no, more than 60% of the available sources. But that's right. The CTAs are not survey instruments. These are things that they looked at because they were interested. That will be important later as well. All right, so how does absorption work? We imagine we have our blazar here, we're over here, okay, and it emits the TV photons that we're talking about. But these TV photons are not propagating through vacuum. There are other photon fields in the vacuum, in particular, the extragalactic background light. And the reason why that's important is because at infrared wavelengths, you're energetic enough to satisfy the pair creation threshold with a TV photon. And so these TV photons annihilate on these extragalactic background light photons and produce ultra-relativistic pairs. The typical length scale for that at Z of 1 is something like 35 megaparsecs for a 1 TeV photon. It's more like 800 megaparsecs today. Okay, so it varies a bit. But certainly, you know, maybe more than galactic scales, but less than cosmological scales. And you can make this quite precise by plotting the optical depth. So these are contours of optical depth. It's a bunch of energy and redshift. And you find, in fact, that 1 TeV, right about here, you're around Z of 0.2. That's when you expect to be absorbed. So the fact that things drop off dramatically around Z of 0.2 is well explained just by annihilation on the extragalactic background light. But then the question that comes up next is, we have this ultra-relativistic pair zipping through space. What happens next? And there's a standard story. And the standard story involves these things called inverse quantum cascades. Okay? That is to say, just like these CV photons weren't flying through vacuum, these pairs aren't flying through vacuum either. There's also all of these CMB photons. Right? And they have a chance of upscattering the CMB photons. In fact, the mean free path to that is a measly 20 kiloparsec or something. Okay, so much smaller than this distance. And when that happens, you produce some sequence or a cascade of G. That's not the only thing that can happen. There's still a lot of these extragalactic background light photons. It can bump into one of those. It makes a slightly less energetic TEB photon, very high energy gamma ray photon. And then that pair produces itself and produces GEB photons. Right. And so through this kind of process, through these inverse quantum cascades, you can take some initial nice, smooth emission spectrum, intrinsic spectrum, and you reprocess it, dumping all of this high energy stuff into energies for which the universe is transparent. And as we go to lower and lower energies, mean free paths get longer and longer, and at some point, right around 100 GeV, you can see across the universe. So it just reprocesses this high energy stuff down to there. All right.
I mean, this might lower the threshold.
Could you pair create on the nucleus? You know, I don't know. That's a good question. I wonder what the cross section of that is. But the I'm sorry. I wonder, given how few nuclei there are, how likely this is. But you know,
it's probably the model.
Yeah, we could actually. I mean, that's an interesting idea. We should listen. Okay. So that's one story. Okay, and that's the standard story, so that's canon. Now I'm going to tell you about the heretical story. Something else could happen. We have this ultra-relativistic pair, all right? But it's not the only one. There are a lot of TEB photons. They're busily pair-creating all around this source. I mean, maybe very beamed, but by the time you get out to 50 megaparsecs or a few hundred megaparsecs, you're very far away. It's very wide. So we have this highly anisotropic, highly relativistic, quite cold bulk flow of pairs. Dilute to be sure, but bulk flow. And these bulk flow pairs are, again, they're not propagating through vacuum, they're stuff. Okay, we already talked about some of that stuff, background photon fields of various kinds. There's also the IGM, giant ionized plasma. So now we have a pair plasma barreling through a giant background plasma. Okay, and that means that we have to worry about the kinds of things you have to worry about when you talk about plasma beams, in particular plasma beam instabilities. Now, I gave a talk last month in detail about how this works. I'm going to just run through some of the results. If you have real questions about how, you know, is this a plasma? You know, am I really being gratuitous in calling it a plasma? It's a few pairs, that kind of thing. By all means, ask me, but maybe save that to the end. All right, so plasma beam instabilities. So here's a numerical simulation of such a thing, fixed simulation run by Brett and his group. And here the beam is some representation of the beam plasma. You can see you grow from very small scale structure up to these large scale structures, these filaments within the beam. All right, and this is just a big happy numerical simulation of a process that plasma physicists have known about for a long time. You might have heard of them too, it's two-stream instability. Okay. And very important, gamma ray bursts, Weibull instability. These are two instabilities where the beam couples to background waves in the background plasma. The distinction is in the two-stream instability, the waves are moving in the direction of the beam, and in the Weibull instability, they're moving across the beam. Okay. And people can calculate analytically what the expected growth rates for those are. It turns out that neither is the maximum of this generalized instability. Maybe we could have the couple to waves moving in any direction, and it turns out there's some oblique direction which produces the maximum growth rate called the oblique instability. All right? And again, this has been worked out analytically, and these are the kinds of simulations people do to try to test this. Okay, so there are instabilities that we might worry about, but there are also complications. Those calculations are in the linear regime. Those are linear growth rates. But we want to know about what the effect is on this plasma beam. We want to know how fast it's going to suck energy back out of this beam. Okay? And that means we need to know about its saturation. And that's probably nonlinear. Now, we do know some things about it. We understand how the Weibull instability saturates. But that doesn't help us a lot, because in our case, the Weibull instability, that branch is probably almost completely suppressed. Okay? People do simulations, like the one you've just seen. And in those simulations, they saturate at order unity. All right, so you really get enormous filamentation in the beam. All right, okay, but those were very different parameters, sets of parameters in the cases we're really interested in. We're talking about a very dilute beam, very relativistic beam. That's just not computationally feasible at the moment. And so there are all kinds of possibilities for how it could be suppressed. All right, so I'm going to say I don't know how it saturates nonlinearly. But in the absence of any better information, I'm going to assume that they grow at the linear growth rate all the way up to order unity amplitudes. All right? And if I were to assume that, then I can draw pictures like this. Okay, so this is gamma ray energy, and this is the cooling rate, and this is for a bunch of different redshifts. And each one of these things evolves as a function of redshift because you have different amounts of the CMB to Compton cool off of, different IgM densities, et cetera. Important lines I want to bring to your attention. One is the inverse Compton cooling rate. Okay, so this is how fast you cool by the canonical process. It's inverse Compton cascades. And the second one is this oblique mode cooling rate. Okay, you'll notice it's higher all the way out to Z of 3. And after Z of 3, or more recently than Z of 3, it's higher by orders of magnitude. So even if it does saturate somewhat lower than order unity, we have orders of magnitude to play with here. So this suggests that these plasma beam instabilities might actually dominate the evolution of these pair of beams and not those inverse Compton cascades. And so now, here comes the hypothesis, okay? I'll call it an interesting result, depending on how generous you're feeling this morning. Maybe you'll agree. On the other hand, if it's not an interesting result yet, you can call it a modest hypothesis. Okay, let's start as a going assumption, and that is plasma beam instabilities, or something very much like them. And as we go through the consequences, you'll see how much like them it really has to be. Assume that plasma instability is something very much like them, efficiently thermalizes the very high energy gamma ray emission from TV blazars. But it's not these inverse Compton cascades. It's these plasma instabilities. And importantly, plasma beam instabilities, you know, unlike those inverse Compton cascades, which produce GeV photons, which then float through the universe, not interacting anymore, decoupling that energy from the universe, plasma beam instabilities, especially as oblique instabilities, thermalize very efficiently. Okay, so that's dumping the energy locally. And that's what we're assuming, efficiently thermalize the very high energy gamma ray emission. So this is the hypothesis. So let's see what we can buy from. Mark Twain's acerbic wit was once turned upon science. This might be true much of the time, but not this time. I think we can rewrite it a little bit. I'm gonna argue that you make this one assumption, and we understand a lot. So this is a good investment of conjecture, as opposed to the bad one that Mr. Twain was talking. All right, so predictions. The first one has to do with the intergalactic magnetic field. This is sort of an unfortunate prediction. A lot of people have been making a career now out of trying to, or an industry at least, trying to measure this. So how do you measure the intergalactic magnetic field? The magnetic field expanses between galaxies and the voids. There's not much there, not much to observe. With TeV blazars, well, here's the standard story. I go look at something that's TeV bright. Okay, and here's three such objects. This is taken from a paper by Naranov and Falk recently where they ran through this. Okay, and there's an intrinsic spectrum I can infer. You know, I know what a spectrum is now. I think I know what the extragalactic background light absorption does to it. So I can infer its original spectrum. Okay, and that means that I can infer what its cascade spectrum must have been. I do that inverse Compton cascade calculation very well. I plug in all the physics I know how to plug in, except apparently plasma physics. Okay, and then I have a bump here. And this dotted line is the net spectrum. That's what I expect to see. Okay, that's the intrinsic plus the cascade emission. And then I go look at it with Fermi, and I rule out this big chunk. And that eats right into the middle of that spectrum. And that's not a trivial. I mean, this is I think this is a three sigma result from Fermi. And it's eating in factors of a few. Here, it's eating in half an order of magnitude. Okay. So you don't see it. There is no GeV bump.
So can I just ask, when you say intrinsic, what particles are these?
What particles?
What particles are being emitted?
Oh, well, we assume that, OK. From the blazars, we know there are TeV photons.
Okay, yes.
The assumption is somehow it's emitting those TeV photons. How exactly it's emitting those?
Okay.
The story is it's inverse Compton. Okay, it's not like starburst galaxies where you're emitting pions or fast protons, which then create pions.
So the intrinsic is supposed to be photons.
Yeah, the intrinsic is photons, right? And then they remember we're moving high energy emission down to low energies, reprocessing by those. And so they look at this and they say, aha, there must be a strong intergalactic magnetic field. And the argument they make goes like this. Here's the TeV photon. Here's the CMB photons. There's the GeV photons. That's what we should see. But if there were an intergalactic magnetic field, these pairs would orbit slightly. They would deflect in the field. And as long as this was beamed, as blazars are known to be, then the beamed emission from the blazar goes off here, just missing us. Okay, so there must be a strong intergalactic magnetic field. And they estimate values between 10 to the minus 15, 10 to the minus 20 Gauss. This isn't so interesting, but this one is enough to make the galactic fields. Okay, you compress, wind, 10 to the 15, minus 15 buys you a galactic field. But even elementary grammarians know that must is, in fact, a four-letter word. And here we have a problem, because here was their argument, but we can find another way to get rid of the GeV emission. That's little plasma waves. All right. So instead of energy going out into these, or going in the wrong direction, being beamed in the wrong direction, the energy is deposited locally, never Compton scatters. Okay? And you can put a limit on how much of an inverse Compton signal you expect, and you find out that for all of the sources that they've looked at, those are those filled dots, and all the sources they could look at, which is all the rest of them. Triangles are HBLs and the blazars I was talking about, that you expect a very small fraction of the final energy to come out in this inverse Compton signal. And worse, these plasma instabilities, if they grow to order unity amplitudes, randomize the direction of the pairs. So if it was narrowly beamed, so within a very small angle, so 6 degrees or 10 degrees, something characteristic of a blazar jet, you've dropped now your signal by a factor of 100 because now it's isotropically spread out after being isotropized by the instrument. Okay, so I said this was an unfortunate result. What it means is that these intergalactic magnetic field measurements are not robust. They don't like that. Okay, but the next one, okay, so this comes to your question. What about the blazar luminosity function? What do we know about how many blazars there are? And assuming different things about that, what do we find out about the absorption? Well, I can construct, remember I said I'm a part-time astronomer, so I can construct a luminosity function out of 30 sources. Don't laugh. You shouldn't believe it. You shouldn't believe it because those 30 sources were terribly biased. Remember, they looked at sources they thought were interesting. That's just the first of the bias. I mean, there's any number of other things. And they did very, nobody has done any work trying to remove any of those biases. All right? But we can do things like pretend that the Fermi hard gamma ray blazars are the same objects that produce these TeV blazars. Okay, and use those to correct for sky coverage and duty cycles and make some sort of completeness correction. Okay? We assume that the TeV observations have a single flux limit, even though there are three different TeV Cherenkov telescope arrays, all independently operating. So three different arrays, single flux limit. It just turns out they work really well. I mean, you can plot the distance flux relation, and you find that it fits a single flux limit remarkably well. I chalk that up to competition. and ignore all the biases that are horrible and inherent. Okay, and you can construct a luminosity function, and that's what these dots are. Don't have a lot of dots, don't have a lot of bins. And you can fit that. I mean, look, it sort of has a break. It sort of peaked there. It sort of has a break. You can fit it with a double power law, and that's what we've done. But I didn't fit the power law indices. What I did was I took the quasar luminosity function at CF 0.1, kind of the average redshift, the median redshift for these objects, and I just translated it down. And if you take the quasar luminosity function and you translate it down, it fits the TV quasar luminosity function. You might say, well, it's a broken power law. Of course it does. I mean, anything will work. Except if we were to do this with Z of 0.5, the Z of 0.5 quasar luminosity function, or worse yet, the Z of 1 quasar luminosity function, it wouldn't have worked at all. So I think this is an incredible plot. I mean, maybe I'm incredibly lucky. You know, it really nails these points amazingly well, okay? But you might guess that at least right now, you know, this is the empirical statement from this fit. Maybe this is true. And if so, it might imply the following things. It might imply that quasars and these TV blazars are part of a single population of objects. Okay, they're regulated by the same mechanisms, and they're contemporaneous elements in a single distribution. All right? And that just immediately brings up the question, were they related in the past? This is all a long way to motivate. Let's stick this in for the luminosity function of TV blazars. Let's use the quasar luminosity function. One big black hole is as good as another. And that would imply that there were a great many more of these objects in the past.
The amount by which you scale down to the 0.1 is equal to 0.1 luminosity function is a free parameter?
Amount I scaled down and the amount I scaled over. Okay, so there are two numbers that we fit. We fit this number here. So that just brings the overall limit down. And this number here, this number could be anything, right? Because you know, these are actually isotropic equivalent luminosities. Blazars are certainly not isotropic, and so there's a complete fudge factor in the blazar jet size. But those are the only two numbers, that one and that one.
Is it roughly correspond to what you would predict? You said blazar is about 6 degrees
on the angles. Oh, no, there's no reason to think that these objects are as intrinsically luminous as quasars. I mean, there's no reason to think that. So this, even if you knew what the beaming was, you'd have to know how luminous these guys were. And I guess we could go try to do that, but we haven't. All right, so that means that there should be a lot more in the past. Okay, here's today, dramatic rise, back to Z of 3. Now, of course, these guys would all have been absorbed, right? Everything after about here would have been absorbed. At least in the TV, it would have been absorbed. Okay? However, these guys down here are what Fermi sees. And so we can go take the Fermi number counts and we can try to figure out, well, are the Fermi number counts, are the objects that Fermi sees consistent with having a rapidly increased population of TV blazars in the recent past? And then these guys, even though their TV emissions absorb, their GeV emission isn't. And we could ask, are these guys and their GeV emission, their GeV background, their contribution to the extragalactic gamma ray background, consistent with the background that Fermi sees. Okay, so we have two handles from Fermi on this distribution. All right, so those Fermi counts.
Sorry. What about the optical path? If you look at the content start.
In principle, one could, but not all optical blazars are TV emitters. So that's probably a little bit hairy. I won't. I'll stick with the thing that's close. All right, so here's the Fermi number counts. So the blue colors are these hard gamma ray blazars. They're peaked very nearby, and they fall off precipitously. Okay, not quite as precipitously as the TV blazar redshift distribution, but still quite a bit faster than other objects. One thing that they usually don't advertise is that here's our sensitivity curve, and you can see these hard guys are also dim. And so they stop being observed relatively nearby just because they're too dim. And so you can go ahead and take our quasar-inspired luminosity function, plug it in to compute exactly what Fermi should have seen, take its flux limit, say how many objects did you have above that flux limit, and you can get different curves depending upon what you assume your flux limit translated into luminosity was. Okay, that is to say, we know, or we've got our model parameterized in terms of the TV laser luminosity, which is different than what the Fermi luminosity is. So let's relate these by a constant, vary that number, and there's one number for which we get exactly the right number of objects, and you can tell that it's also the number in which we match the Fermi distribution quite well. Right, so the Fermi counts, the nearby Fermi source counts for these hard gamma ray blazars is entirely consistent with having a rapidly evolving TEV blazar luminosity function. Okay, so that probe's nearby. So that means we've got the derivative. We're good here. The next thing is that gamma ray background. So they've measured this quite well. And when people try to plug in inverse complement cascade models, people have been trying to fit this for some time, even with models that don't evolve very much, which are very flat, you find that you overproduce this Fermi background tremendously. Okay? So that's kind of a generic result. If you have those inverse complement cascades, it's hard to fit it. And you'd conclude that there were very few TEV blazars at high redshift. However, if you do away with that, if you say that you absorb it and it goes somewhere where you don't see anymore, like heat in the IGM, okay, here's the intrinsic spectrum we assumed. Here is the absorbed spectrum, and here's the absorbed spectrum minus the sources that Fermi should have been able to resolve. Okay, so it's what contributes to the background, and you can see that we fit the high energy part of the Fermi background almost perfectly. The low energy part has contributions from sources that aren't blazars. Those sources dive precipitously right around 10 GeV. All right, so there they come in and fall off. And these are primarily those flat spectrum radio quasars. And this depends a little bit on how you model your individual blazar spectra, and there's some variation amongst them, but within reasonable parameters, we do quite a good job. So what does that background tell you? What is the absorption, how does the absorption affect what you see? The answer is, if you ignore that inverse Compton reprocessing, you are perfectly consistent with the quasar luminosity function for your blazar. So that means that our hypothesis that that energy is dumped into heat in the IGM means that there were many, many more objects in the past. And that Fermi then predicts, it requires that the objects, that the hard gamma ray blazars are in fact similar in their evolution to quasars. That's not just us, other people have done this as well. Okay? So there we go. We have some measurement of this, or some estimate, or maybe that's too strong a word. We have a good comparison. So that's what it implies for blazars at high redshifts. What about heating the universe? I've talked a lot about this energy getting deposited in the IGM. And this gives us an opportunity to heat things up. How much? Well, it turns out that more than photoionization heating. Now, this is usually quite surprising to people because there are a whole lot more UV and X-ray photons than there are TEV photons. There's a whole lot more energy in the UV and X-ray emission from quasars than there is in the TEV laser emission. However, photoheating is very inefficient after reionization. It's limited by recombination. How fast you can photoheat the gas depends upon how fast you can make neutral hydrogen again to disassociate. And it turns out that it's very hard to, very low efficiency for the input energy. On the other hand, with almost order unity efficiency for TV heating, you take all the energy, all the luminosity that come out of TV photons, okay, and you figure out how much what fraction you expect to have of the total accreted energy. Something like 2 times 10 to the minus 8 should be coming out. So the total mass accretion rate luminosity should be coming out 2 parts in 10 to the 8 in terms of heat in the IGM. Okay, and this is bigger than what you anticipate for this photoionization heat. So it can dominate that. But it's very different than photoionization heating. It's very different than feedback. It's very different than most of the things people talk about heating the universe. And the reason is because, one, the homogeneity of the extragalactic background light means that you're affecting things evenly throughout the universe. You're not dominated by high-density regions like you are with photoionization. You have a cosmological mean-free path, so cosmological bias is smoothed out. You have a high density of TV blazars, and so that means that if I ask how many blazars does any patch of the universe see, out to redshift of about 3 or 4, it sees more than one, it sees a few. So it's relatively homogeneous. And the fact that the instability growth rates are very weakly dependent upon the overdensity, they're very weakly dependent on density in general, means that you end up with something that gives you almost constant volumetric heating rates. Not per unit mass, constant volumetric heating rates. And that means that low density regions get hot. And this is really weird. This is really different. Okay, so this is what I was talking about with a lot like plasma instabilities. You need something that gives you something very strange in order to make the things I'm going to talk about next work. Okay? And this isn't like winds, jets, shock heating, or other forms of AGN feedback. And so then we can start to ask, well, we know that the heating is important, and we know that it's funny in that it heats everything up in a constant volumetric way, so it heats up low-density regions more. How do we calculate what the thermal history of the universe looks like? Well, first, let's estimate what the heating rate is right now. And we can do that pretty well, right? We look and see all the blazars we see. We apply our completeness correction. We can figure out what the heating rate at Earth is. And you estimate that today it's about 10 to the minus 7 EV per centimeter cubed per gig year. Is that a lot? Well, if we integrate that over Hubble time, that's enough to get to about 100,000 degrees. So that's a lot. And of course, if we assume that the blazar luminosity function evolved, like the quasars, today we have very little heating compared to what we should have had in the past. And this is what the heating rate looks like in the past. Okay, so it can be order of magnitude larger. So the heating rate at the present time is the integral over the absorption coefficient times the spectrum.
Of the
Earth? At the Earth, yeah. Times constant.
But it depends on the medium that the...
Well, no, so that was the point. That was the point. So this is energetic heating rate, and that's nearly constant with volume. But regardless, I can ask how many TeV photons are coming to me now. I can ask how many of those TV photons are producing pairs now. I imagine we're in the IGM right here, and then figure out how much energy is going into those plasma instabilities now, and therefore how much heat is being produced. And that's what's being done here.
Sorry, what is that sentence? Temperatures 100,000 Kelvin and delta is zero. What's
delta? Matter over one plus delta is the fractional matter over density, mean density. Delta equals zero, mean density.
Oh, I see.
That's probably the easiest one to say.
Well, I thought your point is it's independent of
delta. Ah, the heating rate is independent of delta.
Yeah.
But what temperature you get to? If I dump a given amount of energy, what temperature that raises the local gas to depends upon the number of particles, right? So this gives you a thermal or a temperature density relation that goes as 1/rho. So that does depend upon this. I'll show some pictures of that. So we can go ahead and we can compute the thermal history. There's sort of a standard equation for this. You have your Hubble expansion terms, okay, you have adiabatic heating and cooling, you have terms dealing with changes in composition, and you have your various heating rates, which can come from things like photo heating and where we will add the TeV blazar heating. Okay, and when you do this for a typical patch, here's a curve of the temperature of the universe. So at some point there's reionization, it evolves a bit, then there's helium reionization, and evolves a bit some more. And independent of what this reionization history, the first reionization process occurring, hydrogen reionization, independent of how that occurred, we end up with this kind of attractive solution, this typical solution for what it should look like at the end. And as you expect, the universe is adiabatically expanding, so everything's cooling. You add in blazars, depending upon how optimistic you are, you get something that is an order of magnitude hotter. Okay. Now we can do this not just for a single patch. We can stick in a bunch of different patches and let them evolve linearly. and compute what the thermal history looks like, get the temperature at different times, so that at different times it could give you a density and give you a temperature, and make a scatter plot that shows this as a function of time. And this is what it looks like without blazar heating. This is exactly what we were just saying. All right, low density regions are adiabatically cooled because they're expanding. They're cold. Okay, start hot, get cold. High density regions aren't adiabatically expanding as much, so they don't cool as much. If we were doing a real simulation, I'll show you that in a moment. These would be being shock heated, any number of other processes. Okay. With blazar heating, you see you turn up this low density part of this temperature density relation. And how much do you turn it up? Well, let's rescale this down to the same scale. It makes an enormous difference. Okay. And that's absurd, right? I mean, high temperatures in low density regions, that's just absurd. Why is, you know, is there any reason to expect this? And in fact, there is. There's a measurement based on Lyman alpha statistics. There's a measurement of what that temperature density relation is. And it's inverted. People may argue about whether or not it really is inverted. What's the degree of significance of the inversion? But you know, it's inverted. And we predict both the slope and the magnitude of this. Okay.
Sorry, what redshift is the measurement?
This is at Z of 3, about Z of 3.
I'm just saying, I'm trying to, probably all of the lines of the gas are not in equilibrium at the same temperature, and I'm wondering whether we can also think about this heating affecting Lyman alpha or like 21 centimeter.
We're talking about Lyman alpha, and I'll show you some Lyman alpha calculations. We thought hard about how it affected direct observability, so we couldn't come up with good answers, but maybe you and I should talk about it and see if we can come up with an answer for this question. All right, so this explains these peculiar high Z Lyman alpha measurements. But let's get into the weeds. Let's look at the Lyman alpha forest in detail. Every time we show these pictures, people say, oh, yes, but now you've got to reproduce the Lyman alpha statistics. So we said, OK. Here's a cosmological simulation. They put in baryons. They plugged in blazar heating. So that's changing what the effective equation of state of the baryons are. This is without the blazar heating. This is when you add the blazar heating. This kind of red region, high density region, is kind of like what those plots were before. We see we turn that wing right up, and then you know, it's dominated by what's going on at high densities before. Right? So this is the touchstone with this plot here. Okay? And with these kinds of simulations, you can compute a theoretical Lyman alpha forest. The dotted lines in all of these plots is going to be without the heating. And the colored lines of various kinds will be with blazar heating. Okay, you can see that heating it up reduces the absorption. That makes sense. You heat it up, you reduce the ionization fraction, or increase the ionization fraction, reduce the neutral fraction, decrease the amount of absorption. And so then you can go ahead and you can ask, do I have the right optical depth for Lyman alpha absorption? That might seem like a silly question, except when you do that with the standard model, you get this. And these are the measurements of the optical depth. Something way off. And so then what they do is say, aha, but I didn't really know what my ionizing flux was. So they put in a little fudge factor, they dial it down by a factor of 2, everything works, and they're happy. And they will give you all kinds of perfectly reasonable justifications for this procedure. We don't need to do that. We get it right the first time. Okay? And you can make this more explicit by looking at what fudge factor you need. It turns out that their fudge factor has to have these funny bends in it. It's not just a single number. If you wanted to make ours as best as it possibly could, our fudge factor is pretty close to 1. But the bends are all well within the uncertainty of the data. All right. So the era of fudged Lyman alpha measurements is now officially over. They're on notice. Okay. Well, that's the passage. Great. What about the distributions of Lyman alpha absorption along different lines of sight? Here's the PDF. All right. Again, the blazar models fit the data better. This would get better if we allowed the fudging of the you know, standard model. But the Blazar stuff gets the low density things right, and the standard model doesn't. And that's not surprising, because that's where we have the biggest effect. Okay. You can also look at the power spectrum along a given line of sight. Again, Blazar heating does better. Now, Blazar heating doesn't just give us some sort of statistics for how deep the absorption is, it also gives us information about how broad the absorption lines are. Now they're hotter, they should be broader. We should see that, and in fact, you do. This dotted line here is, again, the standard model, and this guy here is the Blazar model, and this is the probability distribution of a given line width. And they just, you know, cut off, they're suppressed dramatically at small velocities, okay? And that's exactly what the standard model fails to fit. It doesn't get the shape of this peak at all right. Here we get it just about exactly right. You can also look at the effect on the distribution of column densities as well, and again, we do better. And this is, remember, with the most ridiculous possible assumption for the Blazar luminosity function. We haven't tried to change it or mess with it at all. We just plugged in the quasar luminosity function. And so, not only does it explain this inverted temperature-density relationship, but it quantitatively explains the Lyman alpha forest, the high Z Lyman alpha forest. But wait, there's more. We can talk about galaxy cluster observations. I've shown this plot already. Thermal history, big increase in the temperature. We could also have drawn entropy history. So one-to-one correspondence. Entropy is increasing more slowly with the standard model. We give it a big boost. Get up to somewhere between maybe 50 and 100 kV centimeter squared. This is the X-ray astronomer's favorite unit of entropy. It's related to the normal definition by a logarithm and some constants. Okay, so we can dump in, you know, increase the entropy by an order of magnitude in the IGM. Okay, and a way to think of this, to put this in standard cluster cosmology speak, is to think of this as a late time evolving modest preheating. Certainly, you can also think of this as feedback, right? Because these are big black holes powering out something that's heating the universe. Okay, but in this context, it's a lot more like a late time evolving modest preheating. But late time, so, you know, how does that really affect clusters? And to answer that, we'd have to know when clusters form, when cluster core gas is actually falling in. And you can make some simple 1D models of these things, and you figure out that, you know, the cluster is half formed by redshifts between about a half and one. So pretty late, okay? And that means that, you know, if we're heating gas right around Z of one, that potentially we can, you know, dump large amounts of entropy into the center of clusters. All right. And there is evidence for cluster cores or clusters needing an entropy floor. All right. So if you look at large or high temperatures, big clusters, you have this X-ray luminosity going as the temperature squared. But this can't possibly continue because you'd overpredict the soft X-ray background if you got this all the way down to groups. So at some point, this has to deviate. And one way to do that is a floor. Okay. Another way to do it is just look at core entropy profiles. So here's distance, here's entropy, and these are a bunch of different profiles measured showing the entropy distribution in the cores, and they all kind of level off somewhere between a few and up to 1,000, up to 600, right? And there's even evidence that maybe this floor evolves. If you go and look at the central entropy as a function of temperature, for optically selected clusters, these are these filled-in objects up here, they're systematically higher than for X-ray selected clusters. What's the difference between optically and X-ray selected clusters? Optically selected clusters are predominantly young, clusters that are forming stars. So if young objects have a higher floor, then that would make sense with this evolving picture for entropy floors. All right, so what kind of floor do we need? We already have some idea, okay? You know, we can create cluster profiles plugging in our model for the entropy evolution, and depending upon when you made the cluster, when the last bit of gas that contributed to the cluster core accreted, you get different core values, okay? And you expect to have the biggest effect on low mass objects, of course. However, you might notice that if again I make the scales the same, this picture is kind of a pitiful dynamic range compared to this one. Much bigger variation, you have to get to much higher entropies. And you can do that because you don't have to put it all in at once. If I put a modest amount of entropy in early, that increases the efficiency of shock heating and increases then the generation of entropy during merger events. And as long as merger events happen sufficiently rapidly that the cluster cores can't cool, I can invest a small amount of entropy up front and generate large entropies on the back end. And you can do simulations. This is one by Vergani et al. Showing exactly this. No preheating. This is what happens if you just add the floor. But this is if you actually preheat it and evolve it and let big puffy things bump into each other. Okay, again, entropy profile as a function of core radius. All right, you get an amplification factor between 3 and 5. And that means that we have a kind of a median entropy in the core of 150 and a maximum of 600. And that's exactly what you need. Maximum over here is about 600. Okay, 150 makes us our hot cores. Right. But the other interesting thing is that we have these two populations. Now, if Brian were here, Brian McNamara, he might suggest perfectly reasonably that this bifurcation is completely instrumental. You know, it's not real. But nevertheless, we do have a nice picture for it now. These cool guys are early forming objects for which the merger time was longer than the cooling time. They didn't get appreciably preheated, and they lost their entropy every time they merged. These hot guys were late forming objects with a very short merger time scale. Right? These are the guys that blazars preheated. And so that means that the time-dependent preheating not only explains the magnitudes, but also explains this bifurcation. Now, doesn't AGN feedback already do this?
I thought most clusters were for blades.
Well, but now, how late?
Redshift 1, we know.
Yeah, so redshift 1, it might be getting hairy with the blazar heating because it hasn't injected a great deal of entropy.
Right.
So
aren't they all going to be?
Well, no. If they're formed, if they're in biased regions, so they're formed a little bit early, they can be formed easily before blazar heating has an opportunity to dump sufficient entropy into the IGM to affect it. All right, so doesn't AGN feedback already do this? I mentioned AGN feedback, and people certainly think a lot about it. Here's an answer, all right? Entropy versus the amount of energy you see in those enormous bubbles and whatnot. There's a correlation, as you expect. Okay, the more energy in the bubble, the higher the entropy. But there's a maximum, all right? These blue dots correspond to cooler clusters, all right? And they have a binding energy somewhere around here. So if you dump more energy into this binding energy, you start blowing the thing apart. And all the other dots correspond to different temperatures. They, too, get blown apart. And these yellow dots and red dots are really getting quite close. But let's imagine we can even go that high. We're still sitting around 100, and if we wanted to produce the maximum entropy seen, you know, we need to be going out here. All right. So this doesn't happen with AGN feedback, not traditional AGN feedback. All right, so that's clusters. I'm going to start going a little faster now. All right, dwarf galaxies.
So you seem to have a prediction. The clusters that were formed earlier would not have been affected by the heating, and the cluster forms later would be.
Exactly.
So that should be tested.
Yeah.
Just look at the clusters which have.
But to some extent, it's being tested, right, by the difference between the optically and X-ray selected cluster samples. But this is exactly right. Forming structures in a hot IGM. So we've heated up the IGM. Now all of a sudden, forming structures is harder, right? We have a higher genes mass, and the increase in the genes mass is something like 30. Okay. Of course, in practice, you don't use a genes mass. You use a slightly more complicated estimate of the same thing that takes into account evolution. And then you go ahead and make pictures that show a function of redshift, this filtering mass, the mass below which you don't actually collapse. And these solid lines are, again, the standard theory. And the dashed lines are the blazar heated theory. And just focus on the red ones. The blue ones aren't. And the important thing for us is that we start crossing about 10 to the 10 back at Z of 2, maybe 3. and we get up to 10 to the 11 by Z of a half. All right? So we're starting to suppress dwarf galaxy formation quite early, just because we've heated up the IGM. And so we can ask, well, when do these dwarf galaxies form? Again, we have a very similar question that we did in cluster calculations, because we want to, you know, if we have an effect late, is it early enough? Well, depending upon how you measure when you've made an object. Okay, here's one where the temperature, virial temperature of the halo is 10 to the 4 Kelvin. Here's one when you've dumped enough mass in to get up to 10 to the 9. It turns out that an appreciable fraction, surprisingly large fraction, forms late. All right, so about a third of dwarf halos form after Z3. These are dwarf halos. These are not dwarf galaxies. You still got to get baryons in there. All right, so when the galaxy forms depends upon other things. All right, that's theory. When do they actually form in reality? Well, let's go look at them. People have produced star formation histories now of dwarf galaxies. Here's one. Here's a bunch of different tracks. The earliest track is around 10 GigaEars. But there's a whole bunch of these now. Okay, and these are all taken from the same paper. It's an amazing paper, but unfortunately, it's a conference proceeding. It should be published. And again, these 10 gig-year tracks are right in the thick of things. And you can actually ask, well, what does the star formation history look like? Here's the age, here's the formation rate, metallicity. The only thing you need to notice is there's a lot of dark red. Dark red corresponds to old stars. So all the dwarf galaxies they look at were forming stars back before ZF2. They don't see, maybe this counts, but they don't see at least a very significant number of galaxies that form after ZF2, which is exactly what we would think. Okay, so the first generation of dwarf stars before ZF2 was reached.
So this does not suppress the dwarfs?
This does suppress dwarfs, but after ZF3, so it kills about a third of them.
Yeah,
and it doesn't kill the ones you see.
What?
And it doesn't kill the ones you see.
Yeah, but isn't it true that the standard scenarios overpredict the dwarfs by a large amount? You're helping that problem. So it's got to be some other explanation for suppressing the dwarfs.
Well, there are, right? I mean, there are lots of other things that people talk about. I think we have to be careful.
We have to quantify.
They all involve heating of some sort. Yeah.
Some other mechanism for heating at early time.
Yeah. We have to determine what the...
Keep introducing more and more mechanisms for heating.
We have one.
It doesn't do everything.
Not quite.
It doesn't solve the dwarfs problem.
It doesn't solve, well, no, that's right.
It doesn't solve
it. I don't think it completely solves it, but there's a related problem, which it does solve, which is not too different, okay? And this was something brought to our attention after we had written these papers. You got this wonderful email that said, by the way, you solved this other problem. We love those emails, so if you want to send us one, by all means. Also send us emails that say, this is something that kills your model, but... we won't be quite as happy about it. We'll be thankful, but not happy. All right, so the general story is this is exactly like the dwarf problem. It's just for H1 mass in the galaxy. So it's the H1 mass function. And if you stick in preheating right around Z or 2 or 3, you nail the H1 mass functions with the standard cosmology, the standard evolution calculations. If you plug in photoheating or you plug in supernova feedback, it fails rather badly. So it's not clear, in fact, that we don't solve the dwarf problem. It depends upon how big a problem you think it is. Because we solved the dwarf H1 mass problem.
Yes, is there also, I mean, I thought you were going to mention there's this thing that, like, Jim Peebles talks about and stuff like that, that there's two huge galaxies.
So the dwarf problem, yeah, the dwarf problem is multiple things, right? So there's halo dwarfs and there's void dwarfs. This is a little bit, this business was a little bit too quick here, right? Certainly wasn't detailed. We do talk about each one separately in our papers. And there are somewhat different answers, because when dwarfs form in both places is somewhat different. Okay, and I think we do a much better job killing off void dwarfs than halo dwarfs. But it does affect both, of course.
So explain why you're killing void dwarfs.
Well, the void dwarfs just generically form later. Right? They don't form in highly biased regions.
I was going to say, I thought the idea was that you're thinking of a sort of volumetric in preference to heat and low density regions. You might think of better killing and suppressing galaxies
That's right. That's just another way of saying that.
Right.
It turns out that the halo dwarfs mostly are accreted from low-density regions anyway. So it's not like we have to kill a dwarf that formed in the Milky Way halo. All right, so here are the conclusions. My trifling investment was that we assume that these plasma beam instabilities dominate, and I think I gave you a motivation for that assumption. Okay, I didn't prove it, but I gave you a motivation. But if that's true, then you can start explaining a great many things. You can explain the lack of the GV bumps in TV sources without appealing to intergalactic magnetic fields. You can explain the Fermi source counts in extragalactic background. You can explain the inverted temperature density relation in ZF3 in galactic cosmological voids. You can quantitatively understand the Lyman alpha forest at high redshift. You can get the galaxy group and cluster profiles right, both the magnitude and the cool core, non-cool core dichotomy. You can help the dwarf galaxy problem and get the dwarf galaxy star formation histories largely right, or at least the cutoff right. And we can get the H1 mass function more or less right. And so that's a lot of return on your one investment. And so we really do have an embarrassment of riches. All right, well, thank you very much.
Can you observe these instabilities in some other way?
How are you thinking? You mean, can we do them in the lab?
No.
You mean, is there a direct way to tell if... So we spent, in the second paper, we have a whole section on direct detection schemes. And what we found was that it was pitifully small. We thought it was ridiculous that you could heat up the voids to almost a million degrees and not see it. There has to be a way that, I mean, this has to be completely excluded, right? And so we actually sat there and tried to figure out why this was obviously insane and what obvious observational result had already excluded. And it turns out to be very you can't quite get up too hot, right? But you can certainly, at the temperatures we are at, it's really hard to tell that they're there. I think that if people saw the GEV, inverse compound GEV emission, then that might make things a little bit more difficult. There are ways to try to do that. So if you see a TV source and there's an intergalactic magnetic field, it beams it away from you. But what if the blazar is beamed that way? Then there's a chance it'll beam towards you. So you take all the things that aren't blazars, you stack them on top of each other, and you look for the GEV halo. And people have done that and made claims, and those claims went away. But if a actual believable claim came out of that, and they really did see that, then we would have to start thinking, well, wait a minute, there's a lot of energy still in those particles. And then you can start asking if we could calibrate it. I think that's the way. Something that probably isn't satisfying is I would argue that looking at these voids gives you a way to try to use the universe as a bomb calorimeter to measure the Heinrich gamma ray output. That kind of begs the question. So you assume that's been thermalized.
Okay. So, question about this population of the quasars. So, how many, I mean, what's the fraction of the quasars in a cluster? So, don't have such a heating sources. We should see, for example, more population of the dwarf galaxies. And compared to the other samples that we had the quasar.
The role of cosmological bias in the early parts of blazar heating is poorly constrained at this time. One of the things that we're in the middle of doing that Christoph is actually leading is doing proper structure formation simulations with blazar heating that should answer this question. We don't really. But you're right, that you might expect early form clusters to be slightly more effective because they'll produce their own blazars. Even though they're heating the rest of the universe, you know, you still have more beams locally. So.
This N-body simulation should have very high resolution to make this.
Yeah. Well, if there's somebody you want helping you on that, Volker Springle. That's where he is.
Maybe I forgot to ask you.
I think we affect things most significantly on the largest scales. So depending upon what scales he's seeing things on, that will change that. At the end of the day, I think that the systematic uncertainty with knowing your laser luminosity function is probably bigger than the systematic uncertainties that you have otherwise, right? So it may produce large systematic uncertainties. So we took, it's hard to state how remarkable it is that even with the simplest, dumbest prescription, everything just kind of works. There are things that do not follow the quasar luminosity function, like radio galaxies. And so, I made this argument that, hey, look, lasers and quasars are the same. Now I'm happy because one black hole is the same as another. But that's not really true. We know that certain kinds of AGN are quite different than others. And so had these not worked out, we would have had two options. One would be the honorable, it didn't work out, we tried. Two would be the more likely, it didn't work out. But if we just tweak the laser luminosity function, this much, it works. But we didn't even have to do that. Okay, so, but that's always a possibility. So if all of a sudden it started messing up cosmological constraints, I would say maybe the laser luminosity just doesn't change. That would be my first assumption. We've done something slightly wrong. You said two. Is that it? Oh, Adrian.
So it sounds like with the magnetic fields, that there's basically degeneracy given the extragalactic background. Can either postulate that there just weren't blazars there, or that you had your mechanism. There were blazars there, and they had the magnetic field, and that's why we don't see the GEV coming from the sources we know.
There were blazars there, but they emitted in it when it, yeah,
it
right
went
now.
Off.
Yes.
But can we get any more information from like the power spectrum of the anisotropy in the background? Because the magnetic field idea still has that these things are fairly focused; they're just not where we thought they'd. They're not aligned with the sources we know, whereas your model is that it's all diffuse. Is there something in the anisotropy?
Okay. So what you're talking about is doing this blazar GEV stacking analysis better.
You want to
be super sophisticated, okay? But the level at which they've done it is they've taken a bunch of Fermi images and just dropped them on top of each other, and said, "All right, do I see something above the noise?" And this is terrible. For a lot of reasons. The simplest reason is because you have radio observations, these objects line up the jets for Christ's sake, right? I mean, at least make it so the spots would sit at the same place. And they didn't do that. So there are many things that you could do in principle, but if you want to talk about how to do that, I'd be happy to do that, just because I'd be interested to know how much better you do. I don't know if they're at a point where they're doing any statistical analysis. I don't think that they have enough. These background measurements are really hard. They got to subtract off a lot of galactic stuff. So they're beating the systematic and random uncertainties way down by integrating over the entire sky. I'm not sure that they actually could produce a map.
Also, did I understand correctly that you said that if the intergalactic magnetic field is big enough to explain the galactic magnetic field, that it's also big enough to explain the bending?
I did it the exact other way around. But that was roughly the right idea, that the lower limit that they get from the somewhat optimistic and perhaps not entirely rigorous estimate that used the four-letter word must, was up to 10 to the minus 15. And 10 to the minus 15 is enough that if you take a chunk of the universe that makes a galaxy endowed with a 10 to the minus 15 gas field, and you compressed it and wound it a few times, you get to nano gas fields.
So that's
No, not at all. So it's easy to make really tiny intergalactic magnetic fields. And you know galaxies have nanogas fields. What you don't know is how much of the nanogas fields in galaxies were produced by some sort of dynamo in the galaxy, or produced by AGN locally, and how many come from some sort of residual C field in the intergalactic medium. And the jury is still very much out on that issue. And so the reason why those were exciting, the reason why that was a science paper, the Nerudov-Buff paper, was because it was the first astrophysically interesting limit that would start to point fingers in this debate empirically. And that was know, but the jury's still out. I mean, it'd be perfectly fine to say that the cosmos is mostly unmagnetized and galaxies just produce their own fields. And there are lots of ways they could do that.
What about the effect on polarization of the CMB?
Because
if you release all this heat at late times, ionize all the electrons, then you'll get some rescattering of the CMB.
So we looked at the Compton Y parameter on the CMB, and it was way below not only current but future.
That should boost the polarization out of solid.
Polarization
under large angular scales.
So.
Just because you're rescattering the CMB.
But I would naively assume that if the Compton Y parameter was really tiny, that the effect on the polarization, I mean, that's a measure, some sort of a measure of how much scattering there is.
What's
the? We could look it up in the paper. It's there, but it's very tiny. I mean, the thing that I remember was that it was much smaller than even next generation version. So it would be difficult, I think. But you know, again, maybe we should take a look at it.
Yeah.
Or
do you
see
significant?
I don't think it's
really. Well, but if I don't have a lot of scatters, then how do I muck with the polarization significance?
You do have.
Okay.
Is it really?
Or maybe it's too late.
Does it have a significant effect on the optical depth?
Optical depth is too low, you think?
I don't know. That's what I was, does it change kind of the output kind of?
Which redshift does your effect switch on?
The temperature switches on around Z of 3. A D Z of 2.
I think the optical depth is so small anyway.
At that point, what's like a tenth across the Hubble length?